This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon.
Here's the commissioner with the first overall selection of this year's draft.
John Urschel watched the first round of the 2014 NFL draft like a fan. He knew his name wouldn't be called on the first day, but
I was certainly going to be drafted. In fact, I was projected to be like a third, fourth round pick.
Urschel waited all day the next day. No call. By the third day of the draft, he was starting to get nervous.
You get concerned when Mel Kiper has you on a shortlist of best available for, like, pick after pick after pick.
When the call finally came in the fifth round, Urschel and his mom were playing a board game called Settlers of Catan. I love that detail because it is like the geekiest game there ever was.
It is a good game, but I will say, you can get geekier. Like, Settlers of Catan, that's just a gateway game. Like, for instance, if you love co-op games, Forbidden Desert, tons of fun. If you like being competitive, Splendor is a game that I quite enjoy. If you like sort of these mafia-type games, Coup is quite a nice sort of simple game.
I'm not sure what I expected when I sat down to interview the guy who had left the NFL to finish his doctorate in mathematics at MIT, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't a list of board game recommendations. But for John Urschel, games have been part of his life since he was young.
Most kids get their allowance by, you know, mowing the lawn, things like this. My mom, because she recognized that I was strong in math, wanted to encourage me with respect to math.
It started simply enough. Whenever Urschel and his mom were out shopping, she'd ask him to calculate how much change she'd be getting back. If he could do the math before the cashier handed his mom the money, he'd get to keep the change.
And this was a fantastic game. I love this game.
But soon, Urschel's mom realized she was losing more money than she could afford to lose. So she made the game harder. Now Urschel would have to add up all the prices and calculate the total after tax. I can't even imagine doing that. I just can't.
But here's the thing. Imagine how good you would be if that was how you got your allowance.
While Urschel's mom was encouraging him to focus on math, his father was providing a different sort of motivation.
My father played football. He played at the University of Alberta. I just really idolized him, and I really wanted to be just like him.
Urschel's dad had played football while in med school. His mom was a lawyer. But when he was a kid, Urschel hated school. He was counting the days until he could play football. Urschel was too big to play Pop Warner. Youth football has weight limits to try to keep kids safe. So he showed up for the first day of his high school's freshman practice, having never been in a football locker room.
Everyone's putting on their pads, and I have no clue what goes where. No clue. Like, looking back on it now, I'm fairly certain I put on my pads wrong. I'm, like, almost certain that I did not put these on correctly.
But once Urschel got out on the field, there was one thing he knew how to do, almost instinctively. He knew how to hit.
So the next day, they bumped me up to JV.
After one day, you went from freshman to JV.
Yeah. They said, wow, this kid has no clue how to play football, but he's really good at hitting.
4 years later, John Urschel was weighing his options for the next chapter in his football career.
I was very uncertain of where I was going to go. I thought I was going to go play football at Princeton, which my mom was sufficiently pleased with. Then I got some interest from the University of Buffalo. Their academics are not quite as strong as Princeton's, but they have a better football team. And so my father advised me to go to the University of Buffalo for the better football. And my mother was completely opposed.
A better option didn't present itself until December of Urschel's senior year, months after all the top recruits had signed. That's when Urschel was pulled out of class to meet with a coach for Penn State.
When my mom found out that I was taken out of class to talk to a coach for Penn State football, she was livid.
Urschel was Penn State's second-to-last recruit that season. He traveled to State College to accept the offer. That's where he nervously approached longtime coach Joe Paterno for the first time.
He told me that I was the type of kid that they loved having at Penn State. He said they loved having smart, good kids who love football and are good people. And he says, Urschel,
you're going to be a captain one day. I'm the 25th of like 26 people they take. Like, I am the bottom of the bottom. And he tells me this. And what do you know?
John Urschel was named a team captain in 2013, his senior year. But Joe Paterno wasn't around to see it. He had been dismissed by the university in November 2011 after former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky was charged with child sex abuse. Paterno died 2 months later. In 2012, the NCAA imposed unprecedented sanctions against the Penn State football program, fining the school, banning the team from postseason play, and reducing scholarships. Urschel says what happened to Penn State football pales in comparison to the horrific injustices done to Sandusky's victims. But he's also aware of something else. If Penn State had been under sanctions when he was recruited, the school would not have had a scholarship to offer him. And if he hadn't gone to Penn State, he says he might never have discovered something really important about himself. Urschel had always been smart, but he'd never really cared about academics. That changed at Penn State. One day, freshman year, Urschel was in class listening to a lecture on differential equations.
In order to sort of find the solution to one, you often need to solve some polynomial equation.
If you must know, it was a fifth-order polynomial equation. There's no formal method to always compute this sort of thing. So when the instructor asked the class for the roots of the equation, he didn't expect an answer. But Urschel didn't know this was something he wasn't supposed to be able to do. So, to his instructor's surprise, he answered the question. He left class that day with a new thought.
Hey, you know, maybe I'm not bad at this. Maybe I have some natural ability in math. People had always told me I had natural ability in football. In hindsight, I had way more natural ability in math than football. Way more ability.
By the end of his junior season, Urschel had completed his bachelor's in engineering and started a master's in mathematics. He'd also been named a first-team All-Big Ten offensive lineman, and there was a lot of buzz around his future in football. One day, the offensive line coach called Urschel into his office to encourage him to wait another year before declaring for the draft. Had that even entered into your mind?
The NFL hadn't even entered into my mind. At this point, I'm just really enjoying football, and I'm really enjoying playing with my teammates. And I have one more year to play at this university I love with all of my best friends. And I was just so excited.
So Urschel came back for his senior year. He stayed until he was taken in the fifth round of the 2014 NFL draft by the Baltimore Ravens. That's when people really started asking him, "Aren't you worried about your brain?"
I almost never got these questions. But then slowly but surely, they started like picking up more and more and more, in part probably because I was getting more attention, and in part because concussions were getting more attention. I mean, I think our trajectories of attention have sort of, we paralleled each other a little bit.
And because you're getting attention for being smart.
Yes.
Urschel had one diagnosed concussion in high school. It wasn't football related. His second concussion came during training camp, his second year with the Ravens.
And I just got hit in the side of the head. I got blindsided. And I got knocked out.
Ever since he was a kid playing games with his mom, Urschel had entertained himself with math. And he'd kept working on the academic papers he'd started at Penn State, even while he was playing with Baltimore. But when he got that concussion, he found that higher-level math was suddenly out of his reach.
It was so frustrating. My brain is not going. Like, I'm just not capable of processing these things. And I was not someone you wanted to be around because I was so just, like, angry and frustrated.
Was that harder than not being able to go to practice?
Yeah, but I have to say, the not being able to play football, this was also, like, upsetting and frustrating to me. So I was just quite displeased.
But then you got better.
Yeah, and then I got better. And so...
And then did it...
Business as usual.
It never came into your mind?
Nope. In fact, someone asked me about this like a day or two ago, about that concussion and my retirement and like what was the relationship. And I didn't realize this until that person asked me that question. Absolutely nothing. I forgot about that concussion. Like, I really like it happened. I moved on. And I really like forgot about it.
So you're playing in the pros and yep. everybody's asking you about concussions and reminding you
concussion,
of all the horrible things.
Concussion, and brain injuries.
And what do you make of that?
I ignore it. I really sort of decide, no, I'm not paying attention to this. I'm playing football. And whatever happens when I'm 50, 60, 70, it's going to happen. It's going to be fine.
And did that ever change?
Yeah. So this sort of, you know, whatever happens, happens, did sort of change somewhat, especially when I got to MIT.
In January of 2016, during the NFL offseason, Urschel arrived in Cambridge to begin his doctoral studies at MIT.
My love for math just grew even more. And I really thought, man, this is a career I really want to pursue. And I want to be able to do math and teach when sort of I'm 70. And sort of I found out I was going to be a father. I want to be around to like hang out with my grandkids and things like that. People always think about that sort of in a concussion sort of point of view, but I mean this in sort of a holistic point of view. I was really glad to get out and be healthy.
Do you ever today find yourself sitting at MIT saying, I wish I was out on the field?
No. Yeah, that's not a thing.
After starting in 13 games over three seasons with the Baltimore Ravens, John Urschel left the NFL in 2017. He says he settled into retirement really, really well.
Everything I do here on out, this is like gravy. Although maybe I shouldn't tell people that like I would just do math for free because I will be trying to get people to hire me shortly. So pay me a good paycheck. I'm worth money. I'm good at math, I promise.
John Urschel's new book is called Mind and Matter, A Life in Math and Football. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
Support for Only a Game comes from Honest Beef, providing exceptional dry-aged beef via the most transparent and direct supply chain possible. They're family ranchers who believe in their customers' right to know where their food comes from. Come for their family's six-generation story and stay for the quality of their beef. Try their single-animal dry-aged ground beef or their 20-ounce dry-aged ribeyes shipped right to your door. They'd like to be your ranchers. HonestBeef.com.
1965, a darkened street corner in Selma, Alabama, and a murder. A new podcast exposes the lies that kept this murder from being solved.
And explores memory, myth, and accountability for a crime at the heart of the civil rights movement. From NPR, White Lies. Listen and subscribe now.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
53 points! A new...
Liz Cambage, last year's WNBA leading scorer, was traded on Thursday, just 8 days before the 2019 season opener. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter for Think Progress, and by The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Lindsay Phillison.
Liz Cambage, a 6'8" Australian center, one of the most dynamic personalities in basketball. She was traded from the Dallas Wings to the Las Vegas Aces. This ended a saga that has been ongoing since Cambage requested a trade publicly back in January. This is the culmination of her fighting to show her worth and trying to leverage any bit of power she has to get out of the situation she was in. I think that this is really great news, not just for the league that gets one of its star players back, but also for the embodiment of player empowerment, which is something we usually only talk about in relationship to men's sports, particularly the NBA.
Well, I'm especially happy for her because I know she's had some difficult years. And she wasn't happy where she was. I think it's good for the WNBA, considering the hits that the league has taken with Breonna Stewart being out for the year and with Maya Moore deciding to take a year off. It's important to have one of your best players not only on the floor but also happy and engaged. I hope that Las Vegas is it, because I know it wasn't initially the place that she wanted
yeah,
to go.
Right.
But I hope that she can find some joy and happiness there, and it's good seeing her with another talent like Asia Wilson and seeing what they can do together, because I don't think anybody's going to be able to guard them up front.
Yeah. Lindsay, you talked to Liz Cambage last year at the end of last summer, and she told you, quote, "I don't make that much money here. This doesn't pay my mortgage." And it really, for me, thinking about that brought to light how much the WNBA is taking advantage of many of its players, many women who grew up in this country who feel such loyalty to the league and feel like they have to play for little money, play all year round, because they really want this league to succeed. So I am excited to see a WNBA player who's able to sort of use her power to affect her life positively. It's maybe a trade that's bad for Wings fans, but good for the league.
Yeah, look, the Wings have a lot of pieces now. Skylar Diggins-Smith, their other all-star, she will be coming back from pregnancy. She gave birth about a month ago. She's expected to come back this season, but it will probably be much later in the summer, understandably.
Right.
Take all the time you need, Skylar.
Yeah, that'd be incredible to play a month after.
I mean, we've seen it in the WNBA. These women are ridiculous.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that the Wings, they get to move on now from this as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know she did have a pretty good experience last year with the Wings. I don't think this was anything personal. Vegas is not too bad. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, she's actually a DJ.
She'll find a way to have some fun.
I think that she's going to like Vegas a whole lot, especially since they're such a contender.
Well, I do wonder, we're approaching a new CBA agreement.
Yes.
How does a star player really flexing her power in this way affect that fight?
Well, I hope that it helps them find ways in the contract to give players a little bit more control, right, over their situations. The fact that, you know, she was stuck with a franchise that was completely failing, right, in rebuilding mode after rebuilding mode, I think that they're going to need to get creative with different ways to leverage their power. But there's no doubt about it. Liz Cambage generates headlines on and off the court. She's a fantastic ambassador for the game. It's going to really help the leverage of the players to have a marketable star in a big burgeoning market like Vegas.
All right, Michael, you're up.
The NBA once again placed the fate of basketball's best prospects in some ping pong balls and wind gusts that we call the draft lottery. And this year, the joy of the NBA world was Zion Williamson, a freight train with rocket boosters and a snazzy haircut. And all year, several teams, including the Knicks, made brazen attempts to land Zion despite reforms that made it more difficult for teams with the worst record to win. In the end, the New Orleans Pelicans won the rights to Zion, who didn't look all that pleased with the results and fueled speculation that he would execute a power move and end up in a more desired location. That has since been knocked down, but what's going to happen when one of the best players decides he's done with the current structure? This is an era in which players, influenced largely by LeBron James, are flexing their power and determining their future like never before. And not since Steve Francis in 1999 has a player refused to play somewhere and forced a trade. I have a feeling it's only a matter of time before some kid challenges the lottery system, inspires the next big change in the game. My question for you all is, when is that going to happen? And would it be okay if Zion did it?
I mean, I can't really sympathize with anyone not being excited to live in New Orleans. That's hard for me. But I would love to see Zion or any of these players kind of take the system. I mean, we were just talking about Cambage, how she was stuck in a crazy organization because of the draft and the lottery that sent her there when she was 19 years old. It would be great to see the system in flux. And look, players are developing their power. And I think, look, Zion already had such a big following on social media. You've seen players like Luka Doncic who have made names for themselves in the European leagues as teenagers. And I think these are all options that players might be willing to take in order to find a way to have more control over their careers. I do think that we could see it happening sooner rather than later.
I do wonder how much of a deterrent the sort of cautionary tale of Eli Manning is.
That's a cautionary tale? Help me out.
Yeah. In what way?
He won two rings in New York?
Let me explain.
Okay.
Eli was the number one pick in the 2004 draft, of course, and he was supposed to go to San Diego. Instead, he demanded a trade, went to New York. So New York is supposed to be where you go if you want all the big endorsement deals, if you want all the money. And Eli never really had the charisma or commercial appeal of Big Brother Peyton, but I do wonder if his refusing to play for San Diego has actually cost him in the end, cost him in terms of popularity, and of course, popularity results in endorsements.
If I look at Eli's career, he lives in New York, which is a great place to be. And he's won two rings and he beat Tom Brady twice. So I think that overall, he made the right decision.
So why aren't more players doing it?
Yeah, I'm surprised because I remember like in 89 or so when Danny Ferry went to Europe as opposed to playing in the NBA. And he instead of going to the Clippers, he wound up in Cleveland. And that worked out for him in some respects. But players just seem to sort of accept that I'll just go wherever I am and I'll be happy.
It's so hard to buck the system, though, right? I mean, you all.
Yeah, there's a backlash to it for sure.
And it takes someone with Zion's level of star power in order to kind of feel like they might even have leverage, because you know these careers are so short, and that can inspire them to use more leverage, but it can also make them more afraid of any backlash that will come with it. And look, I'm from North Carolina. I love the Charlotte Hornets and all their messiness, and you know, want a system that does find a way for small market teams to compete for big players, but I'd rather see it them have to compete through developing good talent, through getting good contracts, through making their place a legitimate contender than through kind of holding guys hostage in their careers.
Yeah, I mean, if I look at the NBA Final Four right now, the teams that remain, none of them are led by a former number one pick. You know, the Warriors, everybody was drafted after number five. Same with the Portland Trailblazers. That's a small market. Milwaukee is a small market where all their best players are all drafted after number 12. And then the Toronto Raptors, all their players were drafted outside the lottery. Their top players were. So you can build a good team if you just have smart executives. A lot of teams
The Hornets do not. I will. Whoa.
That's a big if. That's a big if. All right. I saw a headline this week that made me think, for a very brief second, that the NCAA was finally doing something right. Here's the headline. NCAA working group to consider allowing athletes to profit from names, images, and likenesses. Great headline. Because a lot of people believe that allowing college athletes to sign endorsement deals for shoes, for example, would go a long way to addressing the inequities in the system. But we have to look at the fine print because this is the NCAA. First of all, the press release stressed that the money would not come from schools. Fine, let the money come from Nike. The press release also said that potential payments would be, quote, tethered to education. And it's not totally clear what that means, but it doesn't sound like a fair free market where players are paid cash for what they're worth. So I'm wondering, is this the NCAA trying to distract us? What do you think, Lindsay?
Yes.
Really?
You know, I think it's really interesting right now. We actually have a lot of politicians who are addressing this on the Republican and the Democratic side. There's a Republican lawmaker from Mark Walker, a representative from North Carolina, who's actually introduced a Student Athlete Equity Act that aims to modify the tax code. So I do think that we're on the cusp of change, but I don't think it's going to come from the NCAA itself without a lot of pressure.
If there's a positive headline for the NCAA, I would definitely view it with skepticism because they have a way of getting everything wrong. And, you know, when I saw the contract that Dabo Swinney got for coaching Clemson, it just made my stomach turn because he was one of the main guys saying that these guys shouldn't get paid. But coaching is not that hard. It's gone on way too far. And the money's gotten way too big for the players to not receive any type of compensation.
Whenever we have these conversations, I get emails or phone calls from people who remind me of how complicated it would be to figure out how the schools pay players and who they pay what.
Do you know how many things are complicated?
Right. Life is complicated.
Of course it's complicated. Let's figure it out. Like, there are plenty of ways to move forward in not a perfect way. There are probably no perfect solutions here, but in a much, much more equitable way.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter for Think Progress and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast, and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
C Since 1952, Hockey Night in Canada has been one of that country's most popular TV shows.
Season. So what a story, and we're delighted to have Derek Dorsett, the pride of Kindersley, Saskatchewan, with us on After Hours. So four tiny screws holding the C5.
And that's broadcaster Scott Oak, one of the hosts of an interview segment called After Hours. After Hours is more about life in hockey than it is about the game itself. But the segment gets even more personal when Oak interviews NHL wing Ryan Reeves.
I have to start with a disclaimer. Ryan Reeves grew up across the street from our home in Winnipeg, and he's best friends with our son, Darcy. So we will try to keep this as professional as possible.
But, good luck.
But really, what are the chances?
For what?
Keeping it professional.
Not very good. Not very good at all.
Reporter Tal Pinchevsky has the story.
In the late 1980s and early 90s, while Scott Oak was establishing himself as one of Canada's foremost sports broadcasters, Ryan Reeves was growing up across the street in Winnipeg. As young children, Ryan and his brother befriended Scott Oak's two sons, Bruce and Darcy.
I literally did everything with them. Playing hockey in the streets, playing, you know, in the middle of winter, making snowmen, just everything kids do, it was me and the Oaks family.
I recall vividly the family, our family, sitting down to dinner and you coming in the house in your robe saying, I'm getting in the hot tub, and you just walk past us and get in the tub while we had dinner.
So. Well, you guys are my second family. Exactly. I was very comfortable walking in your house with a robe.
Reeves left Winnipeg at 17 to play junior hockey with the Brandon Wheat Kings of the Western Hockey League. A year later, he was drafted by the St. Louis Blues in the fifth round of the 2005 NHL draft. Through it all, he remained a close family friend of the Oaks. But things changed dramatically for Scott Oak and his wife Anne in 2011.
Bruce had been struggling for 4 or 5 years with addiction. His life had become a roller coaster of active addiction, recovery, relapse. And despite how much love and support we gave him, and we gave him a lot because we did everything we possibly could to keep Bruce alive, that roller coaster just went on and on until March 28th, 2011, there were to be no more attempts at recovery because we got the call that no parent should ever get, and that was that Bruce was dead of an overdose in Calgary.
I was in St. Louis for the first time. I just got called up for the first time in my career. That was the first time I'd ever played in the NHL. So, you know, my dream had just come true, and then a couple weeks later, you know, one of my best friends died.
Reeves wasn't sure whether he should take a leave from his new team.
I didn't really know how to handle it, whether I should get back to Winnipeg for the funeral or whatever. So I called Scott and Ann, and Scott told me, you know, don't you dare come back. You're chasing your dream right now, and I don't think Bruce would want you to come back. So it was a really tough decision not to go, obviously say bye for the last time, but you know, just having Scott and Ann's blessing to stay here was enough for me.
Reeves stayed with the team and eventually earned an everyday spot in the lineup. After that 2010-2011 season ended, he returned to Winnipeg for the first time since Bruce's death with a special tribute to his late friend.
So I got a tattoo of a empty boxing locker, basically with a pair of boxing gloves hanging and a microphone sitting on the locker. You know, Bruce was taking boxing, and he was really big into the kind of the underground freestyle scene. So, you know, that's what the microphone and the boxing gloves are for.
I remember thinking, wow, that is neat. Kind of took my breath away.
Reeves continued to establish his place in the league. After 7 seasons with the Blues, he was traded to the Pittsburgh Penguins in June 2017. Less than a year later, he was traded again to the Vegas Golden Knights. By then, Reeves had already been interviewed by Oak for a 2017 After Hours segment. But it was as a member of the Golden Knights that Reeves' on-air relationship with his childhood neighbor flourished. Last summer, as Vegas embarked on an improbable run to the Stanley Cup Final in its inaugural season, Reeves and Oak became something of a regular feature on Hockey Night in Canada. Their exchanges became especially colorful when Vegas played Reeves and Oak's hometown team, the Winnipeg Jets, in the Western Conference Final. Naturally, Oak was there live on the air, a microphone in his hand.
How many family and friends are today? I don't know. I'm cutting my family off. They're wearing too many Jets jerseys when I invite them to the game. So I don't know. My mom, my dad are here, and that's about it. A couple of buddies.
Okay, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, your son, too. I'm going to talk to him. Don't worry.
We'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Scotty.
Thank you, Ryan.
I love you.
The exchanges were typically lighthearted and fun, like in Game 5 of that series when Oak interviewed Reeves during intermission.
And he decided to rub my head, because Ryan always has to have the last word. And it's not a good look for me because I'm follically challenged, as most people would know. But anyway, what could I do about it? And then he scored the goal that eventually finished the Jets. And so the rubbing the head thing became standard for him. He thinks it's a form of good luck and does it whenever he has an opportunity. But I go along with it.
It's all just the latest chapter in the special relationship between two men who have become family.
I think it's just fun that we can, share in the good times and help each other in the bad times. I think it's fun that you can just be able to go through that with, a very close family of yours like that.
But it's like watching one of your own kids grow up. He's done really well. And, as a family, as an entire family, my wife and Darcy and I were very proud of him.
That story came from reporter Tal Pinchevsky. The Oak family is about to break ground on the Bruce Oak Recovery Center in Winnipeg. Scott says Ryan Reeves has made several contributions to the family's foundation. In early September, with her youngest child off to college, Anna Cruz got an email inviting her to try out for the Washington Wizards' new over 50 dance team.
Boy, oh boy, it seemed like perfect timing to me.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the journalists breaking the big news stories and with the authors, filmmakers, and musicians behind the best in pop culture. Interviews to keep you informed and entertained. So listen and subscribe.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the aspiring Milwaukee Bucks beat writer who traveled 10,000 miles and spent a bunch of his own money to cover the team. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
The Boston Bruins swept the Carolina Hurricanes to advance to the Stanley Cup Finals. Was this one really all about the hot goalie?
It was all about the hot goaltender. Absolutely. Tuukka Rask, who has felt the wrath of the unreasonable, which is a pretty good percentage of Boston sports fans generally and Bruins fans in particular, has been beyond description in the playoffs so far. I mean, everything that makes a hot goalie, he's got going for him times five.
Well, as you say, it is hard to know where to begin. But how about this stat? In potential series-winning games this postseason, Rask has a .990 save percentage. Is it too early to compare him to Tim Thomas 2011?
No, not at all. I mean, Ken Dryden in 1971, Patrick Roy a couple of times. No, this is a remarkable streak. Usually this stuff doesn't stop. I mean, you don't go back to being bad when you're like this. If he just goes back to being average, the Bruins will win the Stanley Cup.
Meanwhile, over in the Western Conference Finals, the big news is the officiating. During overtime in Game 3 against the St. Louis Blues, Timo Meier of the San Jose Sharks swatted the puck with his right glove to a teammate who passed it to another teammate who scored the winning goal. That's not how it's supposed to happen, is it?
No, but it's the way it happens in the NHL, which can't get its officiating or its replay policy right. There were four officials on the ice. Somebody should have seen the guy swat the puck. This is enormous embarrassing. What is ironic, though, in the first 5 or 6 minutes of the Carolina Bruins game, there were four hand passes called. So, yes, it got the attention of the folks in Toronto, I'd say.
Well, the league has clarified the policy. Apparently, a hand pass that goes into the goal is reviewable, but one that leads to a goal is not reviewable. Well, that just makes all kinds of sense, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you have to immerse yourself in hockey logic. No, they obviously will clean this up in the offseason, but it's a very embarrassing thing to have happen in overtime in the playoffs.
Kevin Durant has been ruled out of Game 3 and 4 of the NBA's Western Conference Finals with a strained right calf. So far, the Warriors are doing just fine without him, but you absolutely will not hear them saying that. Is getting Durant back on the court as essential as the post-game interview bites would suggest?
Probably not against Portland, but definitely against, I'm assuming Milwaukee will come out of the East because they're the best team in the league. They're going to need Kevin Durant against Milwaukee. They're going to need another scorer there. But now, I mean, they're getting great minutes out of Andre Iguodala, who's somewhere between 35 and 300 years old. They've still got Steph Curry. They've still got Klay Thompson, and they've still got the way they play the game. So, no, I don't think it's going to hurt them that much against Portland, but they will need him against Milwaukee if that happens.
Durant can opt out of his contract with the Warriors in the offseason, and the Warriors say signing him to a new contract is their top priority. But will singing his praises while he's out injured do anything to keep the Knicks from luring him away?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think it will be a harder decision for Durant than simply going where the money is, because the money's going to be insane.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want to sign a board with the Knicks? I mean, you're with the Golden State Warriors, who are good for at least two more appearances in the finals, let alone winning the championship, and you want to go to, like, the NBA's most prominent plagueship? No, 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 no.
As of Thursday night, the San Diego Padres hold a new record. Thursday was their 8,020th game without a no-hitter, which is the longest drought to begin a team's existence. So kudos to the Padres.
It's a remarkable statistic. The Padres have had good pitchers. And usually, at the very least, you get some guy up from AAA who stumbles into a no-hitter. This is amazing to me. I'm really hoping they never get one now.
Well, for the record, 8,020 games is just over 50 years. The Phillies once went 8,944 games. That's 58 years. So the Padres have a ways to go still.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, at the very least, I want them to get to 10,000. I want them to play 10,000 games without a no-hitter. Or for them to get one and lose the game, which is also possible.
And finally, Charlie, a judoka from Portugal has been disqualified for, quote, grave infringement involving a metal object in the ring. Sounds awful. What did he do?
Well, I mean, I guess the rule is put in to keep people from using brass knuckles or, you know, samurai swords and stuff. His telephone fell out of his pocket. I guarantee you he didn't know it was there. You know, it's probably a long time between bouts, and you know, he's a youngster, so he can't be too far from his phone. Either that, or he was going to, like, tweet out move by move in the bout. Just drop the guy with a great, you know, whatever a judo move is.
Whatever.
LOL, this guy can't beat me.
Charlie Pierce joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Last year, Anna Cruz began to experience dread. Her youngest child, Taylor, had been accepted to Clemson University, and Anna would soon be living in an empty nest.
And even though you know it's coming, right? I mean, the calendar pages keep flipping. It is something you can't anticipate how that's going to hit you. You just can't until you're in the middle of it, until you're experiencing it.
Taylor left home in August of 2018.
Your mind knows this is a positive milestone, but the profound emptiness, you know, it's just hard to describe. And so I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do? What am I good at anymore?
To answer those questions, Anna Cruz had to look back at something that she had been good at four decades earlier. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
In 1978, Anna Cruz was 21 years old. She worked as a word processing specialist in Maryland.
And was driving home from work one day and heard an ad on the radio for tryouts.
The NBA champion Washington Bullets were holding auditions for their dance team.
And I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go and try out.
Anna didn't have an extensive background in dance, but she went to the tryout anyway.
all the way there, and even when you get there, you're like, what the heck am I doing? Why am I here? What am I doing?
Anna says most of the other dancers were NFL or college cheerleaders. But she made the 1978-1979 Washington Bullets dance team.
All of it, you know, the friendships and the performances, even the practice, you know, it was all exciting.
Anna planned to try out for the Bullets the following season, but
in the fall of 79, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Very unexpected, very out of nowhere. It just was a little bit of an ordeal.
After a year of fighting, Anna beat the cancer. She returned to her job as a word processing specialist, but not to the Bullets. In the late 80s, she gave birth to a daughter, the first of her three kids.
My greatest joy, hands down, has been being a mom. So I just poured everything into that, you know, into the stuff at school, into, yeah, they can all come over, into this and that. So it would have been lunacy to me if I had thought about dancing, even as a hobby, or, you know, going to take a class or anything like that. It just wasn't even on my radar.
But that wasn't entirely true. Sometimes when Anna watched dancers at an event or on TV, she'd remember how much she loved being one.
You know, maybe sit there and let my mind wander about knowing how that felt and how exciting it is and betting I could still do that move.
The years flew by and Anna's two oldest kids left their home in Greenville, South Carolina. Then, in March of 2018, the Washington Wizards held a 40th anniversary celebration of the franchise's only NBA title from back in the days when they were still the Bullets.
And so they invited all the players back and the coaches, and then any of the dancers through the years. I think there were about 60 of us, and we got to perform at this event. It sure reminded me of how enjoyable it was and the feeling you cannot describe, you know, while you're waiting there in the wings and you're waiting to go out there and perform.
Anna wanted to hold on to that feeling. Her youngest child was preparing to leave for Clemson University in the late summer, and that empty nest was looming.
And so I'm thinking, what in the world am I going to do? What am I good at anymore? Then this opportunity with the Wizards showed itself just absolutely out of nowhere.
In early September, about a month after her daughter left home, Anna got an email.
And boy, oh boy, it seemed like perfect timing to me.
The Wizards were holding tryouts for a new dance team, or perhaps a new older dance team. It was for dancers 50 and older and was sponsored by the AARP. It would be called The Wisdom.
God was saying, here, and here's an open door. Now, what are you going to do with it?
Her answer was to, in her words, get serious about my moves. She learned the latest hip-hop steps on YouTube. Her younger daughter taught her what she called booty pop. In late September of 2018, undeterred by the 8-hour drive from her home in Greenville, she tried out for The Wisdom.
Again, you know, I get there and I'm like, what am I doing? This is ridiculous. But it was my heart's desire to do this.
Anna had hardly danced over the previous 40 years. She says there were more than 80 dancers at the tryout, ranging in age from 50 to 76.
What's your dance experience?
Well, I was at the club last night, pretty good.
Absolute characters, totally uninhibited, you know, comfortable in their own skin, and just entertaining folks.
One, two, three, clap it four, to the left. Five, six, seven, to the back. Goes one.
Anna was told final decisions would be made in a couple days. She waited about a week and began to think she hadn't made the team. Then late one night, she got an email.
And I had just gotten home, and there it was. It was so exciting.
Anna Cruz had been chosen as one of the 20 members of the Wisdom Over 50 dance team. Her daughter, Taylor, happened to be home from Clemson for a visit.
And she was screaming and jumping up and down with me. And yeah, I didn't feel like a mom and a 60-year-old. I felt like a girl.
Anna was once again a member of an NBA dance team. She says she was nervous about making the 16-hour round trip by herself. But then she began to enjoy the drives to practice every Sunday. Sometimes she'd take a route that would bring her through the Shenandoah and Blue Ridge Mountains.
It's just breathtaking scenery. I learned that I could make eating an apple last 30 minutes. So it was just part of the journey. It just became part of my routine.
After a while, she learned not to dread the eight-hour drive.
I mean, if I'm making good time, 7.5.
The Wisdom got just 4 practices in before their debut on November 24th, 2018.
Make some noise for the Wisdom!
The fans, so gracious, and the affirmation from them, and the excitement of the fans to this over 50, like, what are these women out there doing? When we came off the court that first game, I mean, these ladies were screaming and hugging.
Let's go. She just wanna pop, 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 pop. Yeah,
3 of those women were on the Bullettes with Anna 40 years ago. Another dancer, whose grandson is a member of the Wizards' regular dance team, is 76. One of them is a guy, and all of them have moves.
You know, to see these women in their 60s and 70s who are shaking their groove thing and doing like the Tootsie Roll and these dances, and just the sheer fun and the joy we're having, you know, like whoever's watching us or cheering us on is like, we're you.
For the record, Anna's husband Michael is completely supportive, but maybe not always for the right reasons.
Oh, he's gotten some mileage out of this, I don't mind telling you. He'll say, well, I told him my wife dances for the Washington Wizards, and they're like, what? How old are you? The guy has played that card more times than I care to think about.
The Wisdom danced at 10 games last season. Sometimes Anna stayed with friends or at a hotel so she wouldn't have to commute for a game on a Friday or Saturday and then again for practice on Sunday. And Anna realized something. Maybe the dreaded empty nest syndrome wasn't so dreadful after all. In fact, she says having no kids at home was the only way she could have chased her latest dream. And the whole experience gave her new confidence.
It makes you feel like, well, if I did that, I know I can do this. And I can do it. Like, here I am 61 years old, you know, but I have learned that I still have stuff to learn, right?
Anna will spend some time with Taylor when she's back from Clemson this summer. And this time, she's looking forward to the fall. She's going to try out for the Wisdom again.
You know, now that I've been bit by this bug, how can I not?
I hope you make the team next year, if that's what you want. But if you don't make the team, what are you going to do to sort of fill that void?
Well, hello. I don't know if the Charlotte Hornets have an over 50 dance team, but I think they should.
They don't, which is too bad because Anna's commute to Charlotte, North Carolina would be a mere waltz, less than 2 hours each way. But maybe soon. There are already about a dozen 50 and over squads dancing at NBA venues, and that number is likely to increase. For Anna and all the other dancers 50 and older, that sort of growth is good news. The opportunities it brings just never grow old.
That's Only at Games' Gary Wallach. To see Anna Cruz and the Wisdom dancers doing the Cabbage Patch and the Electric Slide, please shake your groove thing over to onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Gibbon. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.